The name of the program is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. Our guest is Michael Glaser, author of A Lover's Eye and In the Men's Room. I am Grace Cavalieri. Michael is going to open the show with an opening poem.
Thank you, Grace. This is called At Duntulm Castle, Isle of Skye, Scotland. It used to be just snuggling for its own sake, but here by Duntulm Castle, on a bench where the sea wind blows its chill inward, my daughter snuggles in, tells me she is cold and I am warm. I squeeze her close. My hands rub up and down her arm as if to build a fire. In the distance, the Hebrides rise through the sea mist as if marking the borders of the world. My daughter puts her head on my belly and, remembering the conversation from breakfast, says with a generosity I treasure daily, "If you lost weight, Daddy, you wouldn't be as warm as you are." How we define the borders of our lives, I think. How blessed are their mysteries. I look out at the blue mountains, feel the stiff salt wind against my face, and not quite daring prayer, simply imagine I might hold my daughter in this safe embrace forever.
The voice of Michael Glaser. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Now, Michael, we're going to talk about your poetry and the titles of your book, but I want them to know who you are, first of all. Michael Glaser is professor of literature at St. Mary's College of Southern Maryland, and he has actually turned Southern Maryland into a nationally known oasis for poetry. And in fact, it has been called the place and the hope for poetry's preservation and continuation. Does that surprise you, Michael?
Nice words, Grace. Thank you.
It's true words, Michael. And to start with your own work, now you have written A Lover's Eye and In the Men's Room. The latter one, In the Men's Room, that title, what does that mean? Is that metaphor? Is it in the men's room of the heart, in the men's room of the mind, or in the men's room?
It's all of those, and probably a bad metaphor, but wanting to play with that notion that about the male experience, and also a place to put a few of my bathroom poems that are probably more serious than not. But so that's where the title came from, for better and for worse.
And that's a prize-winning book, so we should respect that.
Well, thank you.
It is. It won a national award and a national publication award. And so irreverent. Some of those poems were during a time when you felt that men should be allowed to have some say also. Some of it came out of a wish to be heard from the movements, maybe from Robert Bly,
well,
am I right?
I think that feminists, and I think the feminist movement has been very important, but I think it ended dialogue and debate. And so the need for men to speak of their own experience and to struggle for their own understanding of what it means to be male and how to be gentle male was very important, that for that to be defined by men rather than being stridently told what to be by women.
And I need a man with insight and consciousness, which is what you've given. In fact, all I know about men actually is from the poems they write. Mm. So keep writing them. We're going to hear some more work. One other book is called A Lover's Eye. So what would that title lead us to believe about the contents?
Well, I hope I try to look at the world out of a lover's eye, and I hope that the title reflects some of that. If I can segue, this next poem in a sense does, in trying to, I mean, for me, I guess a lot of what I've learned about being male comes from my experience of being a father.
Father of Brian, Joshua, Daniel, Amira, Eva, husband of Kathleen.
Right.
Let us hear the next poem.
This is was written for my daughter, Eva. She was going to a dance camp this summer, and I was away at the Omega Institute in New York at a poetry workshop. It was called Summer Dance Camp, First Day, A Letter to My Daughter from My Poetry Workshop. Today, we both rise from strange beds, into unfamiliar rooms, uncharted ways. Your dance, my song, these wild infusions of art we have given ourselves to. You are scared, me too. Your sweet years provide no mask for fears, but my cool, despite its practiced class, is at best a dangerous craft. Let it pass. Today, may we leap into the mystery, a twerjete, a poem. May we both land lightly. I will place your words on this page, and you will point your toes. Each according to each, we arrange things just so. First draft, first position, fourth, fifth. Each move an exploration, a master class. Even apart, we move on parallel paths, home, then away, plié, élevé, extend, return, then home again.
A whole new bunch. Let's hear another.
Fractals, a poem that the setting for this, the writing of it at least, is Maine, the shoreline of Maine. Fractals. Perhaps Monet had it right, painting his myriad dots into shapes our eyes converge to sight. Consider this shoreline in Maine, a billion chaotic rocks scattered in a glacial sigh, the flotsam of the sea, the unsteady sea itself. In the distance, hills rise like mountains, or so it seems. What is landscape but a myriad of details, like the aching of the unseen bell sounding the rhythms of the waves, the tumbling of a million, million molecules bonding, breaking. What is the whole but a particular collection of parts shaped by chance or love or fear? What is any gathering of things but what we choose to see, to hear?
Michael, listening to those poems, I would say that you write out of a sense of place, because those are the poems, that is what is being said to me, very much visually, a sense of texture, scene, castle, wind, salt. But is that the way a poem begins usually for you? How do you usually, what is your process? Everyone's is different. This group sounds as it came from place.
Well, that's I don't know. My process changes, but I guess it does come from place. I write a lot when I travel, because traveling helps me be more awake and see things more clearly. I think I write from image, but that image is always attentive to place, always attentive to, a theme that I see recently running through my poems, although not necessarily explicitly, is trying to understand what home is and how that more and more seems to be a place in the heart rather than a particular physical place. But the physical places help me get closer to understanding what that is.
And so being away from home, you find coming home to yourself much more apparent.
Good.
I have known your work for a very long time, and if I were to analyze it, I would say that we start with relationship, place, but there is always an overriding philosophical idea that comes into the poem. Now, you can't plan that ahead of time, I'm certain, or it wouldn't work. But wouldn't you say that was characteristic of you?
I'd like to think so. Thank you. I mean, I'd like to hope that the particular becomes a microcosm for larger issues, and that part of how we celebrate our individual experiences is by understanding their connections to the larger world.
Do you feel that the idea comes to you in the writing of the poem, that all of a sudden emerges this bigger thought that you didn't know was lurking there?
More times than not, that the writing is a discovery process. That's, I think, why I like writing so much, is that it really is a way of exploring my own experience and discovering meaning in that experience.
Well, let's see if it holds true for this next poem, and then we can take you further and farther. Okay. This is Michael Glaser we're talking to. I am Grace Cavalieri. We are at the Library of Congress, and here's Michael.
Before the morning paper. Before the morning paper, when the world is still the twilight calm that follows waking, the air is fresh with morning rising, and the sun casts its slant of clear shadows across the landscape. Before the morning paper, my wife is elegant in her rising. The curve of her back stretches from the bed, and my children, not yet recalling that we have left the garden, come tumbling in for morning hugs. Before the intrusion of the outside world, dutifully subscribed to and daily read, as if doing so somehow holds back the floodgate rising outside the front door. Before even the first sneeze of the day, I stop to inhale the morning deeply, to remind myself to carry this gratitude into the world beyond the morning paper, beyond the front door, beyond the first sneeze. Achoo! Achoo! Bless you. Bless you.
That bless you is characteristic of Michael Glaser, too. And we won't tell the engineer to take that sneeze out. That's in, on the
part
page.
Part of the poem.
Is part of the poem. Michael has been honored by several organizations. I think one which matters a whole lot is the Columbia Merit Award for Service to Poetry, and that's given by the poets, the metropolitan poets of Greater Washington, D.C., and to be honored by your peers is especially gratifying, I think. He's also won Individual Artist Award from the state of Maryland. He has been published widely in over 200 journals and magazines and continues to do so. So, and this new influx of poetry I've never seen, it looks like a new manuscript. What would this be called?
Don't know yet.
Mm.
Just happening.
Mm. And I see the the overarching themes of you mingling with nature show up in these poems, too. The last thing I read of yours was like a 500-page notebook called Walking with Adam?
Right.
Yes, and that was Meditations with Nature. It was a poet talking to the world as he walked through the world. How would you describe that better?
It was a walk. I called it a walking journal. I was able to, for a period of about a year and a half, pretty conscientiously walk to work. And I'm able to do that through woods, along a river. And I kept a journal of that process. It was a wonderful experience for me because over the seasons themselves in the woods become a marvelous metaphor for life, birth, death, regeneration, composting.
And you didn't hope for publication as you did it. You just did it. I think that's an important thing, that was just who you were, and you weren't saying, oh boy, if I just get one more turtle in my view, I can send it to Norton. I mean, you really did it as a pure act.
It was.
And that's what
it
makes
was.
It work.
Yeah.
But I think poets and nature are actually a very hot item right now for publishers.
Well, the journal was pure. The experience was not all that pure because what I found and still do is that when I walk through nature, I get very, very centered. And then coming out of that, I'm in a marvelous place to revise my poetry. So that was part of the impetus for that walking to work. I'd come out of the woods. I have about a half a mile, three quarters of a mile left before I get to my office, and that's a very fertile time for revising.
It's very important to us to know where your work comes from and the source, and walking is one of them. Your family is clearly another of them. This year, you studied with two luminaries in the poetry world, and I'd like to know something you learned from that. Tell us who each was this summer at the America Institute.
Thich Nhat Hanh, a 5-day mindfulness workshop.
Tell us who he is.
And he's a Vietnamese Buddhist monk, and just a marvelously holy man, gentle and wise and kind. And the opportunity to be in his presence, just astonishing.
What did the poet learn from that?
I'm still discovering what I've learned from that, but some of it is a kind of gentleness and a much greater awareness of how we are as humans connected to all things, a much calmer sense of the cycle and recycling of things, and also the responsibility for living carefully and mindfully in the world.
And mechanically, you said you learned to chew your food a lot.
We practiced that.
Yeah,
yes.
You practiced that. But you know, that's not funny.
No.
If you take that as symbolic of the way we could live and taste things and sit with things and take them into our bodies, that is very significant. So every little thing you did there must have worked out.
Exactly.
And then you worked with Sharon Olds. And so what thing did you bring back from her?
Then
approbation.
Then a five-day workshop with Sharon Olds, a new poems workshop. And that was a wonderful opportunity to just to write, particularly at the end of the Thich Nhat Hanh experience, and to give shape and meaning to that in a group with other writers. And Sharon is a wonderfully affirming and nurturing person, so it was grand to be with her in that experience.
Are these new poems from that experience?
Not exactly, but they all come out of it, yes.
Let's have one more.
This is an older poem, actually. It's called Angels of Sunlight. As I read Zen in the morning, my young daughter leaves her bed and lies next to me on the sofa, where sunlight angles through the window. In half sleep, her brown eyes stare off at the large oak unleaving in front of the house. I cup her head in the palm of my hand, feel the chambers of my heart fill and empty, like the sunlight warming this room, like the words on the page fill my spirit, like the air in her purple balloon, like the breath of her lungs as her chest rises and falls, like the leaves on that tree dancing in the wind and knowing, as they know, something important about attachment, about letting go.
Do they like being the subject of your poems? Sometimes.
Sometimes. Eva does. Eva loves opening my mail and reading rejection slips. And she also likes when I get paid for a poem about her. She likes to consider that she's due some of that money, and she lets me know that.
Oh, that is good. And so she's working her own house.
Working her own, yeah.
That is great. I'm going to take you someplace out of your house now. You have been in the world really pressing up against it, making it happen for nigh on to 30 years, writing and helping writers, teaching writers, making a place for writers, creating festivals, series, reading series, doing what you can. Now, we're approaching the millennium, and you have watched poetry struggle on its little unsure feet for many, many, almost half a century. Where are we going as we get to the year 2000?
No, it's an important question, and I don't know that I have an answer, but I sure am interested in exploring what that is. Part of what I think I do understand about that is what W.H. Auden said, I think it was 1953, something to the effect of the one political duty of the artist, the poet, is the preservation of the language, by which I understand him to mean that if we ever get to a place where we can no longer hear language truly spoken, when we can no longer recognize truth when it is spoken, we become lost as a civilization and as a society. And in a world that increasingly is filled with misuse of language, advertisers and dissemblers of language, I think it becomes crucial that the arts remain as vibrant as possible, and perhaps poetry most importantly, because it is through good poetry that we learn to recognize language truly used and truly spoken.
I often think it's important that there's nothing to get in poetry, because therefore there's no deceit, really. If there was a great big windfall for us placing the words on the exact same page in the right presentation in the prettiest way, that would change it to a form of advertising. Who could do it best? Who could do it prettiest? Who could polish the words? I think it's kind of nice that there's nothing to gain whatsoever. As I've said a million times, there's no stall in the marketplace. And I think there's a reason for that. So in your work every day, and you never get tired of doing that work, that's what amazes me, you really believe that there is something about our humanity that is being held up and shining by the use of our language?
I think that that poetry is about things that matter. And good poetry is about things that matter importantly. So that to be involved in the making and the reading and the understanding of what matters is a holy life. It's a great joy and an important way to live and an important thing to share. Not that there are particular ways of making meaning that one has to follow, but that we honor ourselves and our experience here by working to make meaning and to do that in ways that matter in the world.
How many students have you had in 30 years?
Oh,
hundreds.
I haven't tried to count that.
Every one of them carries that beacon of light out. Every single one of them. I met a recent student of yours last week at Borders, and she was just from a workshop that you had in the spring. Last spring. And I was just amazed at how the message is internalized and they go out in the world rinsed off and unruined. And I think that's pretty nice to spend your life that way. So, Michael Glaser, I call you and I call this program a community of poets because that's what you've turned the world into, maybe the globe. Let's go forward with your own work for a moment and then I'll hit you up for some more profound assessments of what it's like to be alive.
Some of where the legacy comes from, Grandmother's Bureau. From the time I was 7, the top drawer was the drawer of my fascination. Each year I'd return to study the treasures there, old rings and bracelets, a pocket watch, a silver box with jewels set in the top, pills and hairpins, pearls and sachets of sweetly smelling things. And above, wedged into the edges of the bureau mirror, the photos, her sisters and cousins, great aunts and uncles, and my grandmother's parents gathered at her grandfather's gravesite before they left Poland for America. I'd stare at them for hours, these images, my ancestors, people I had never met and could barely imagine, until there in the center I noticed one year, rising up out of the mottled silver mirror, my own face reflecting back at me from a past that aimed both to claim and set me free.
Michael Glaser, we're at the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We talked about your school a little bit, and I think now is the time to say the spectacular event that you're gearing up for. And when I say poetry festival, those two words are easily said, but what do they take? And what is a poetry festival, and what are you doing?
Well, we've been running a poetry literary festival for 20 years at St. Mary's College now. And this coming year, our 21st on the cusp of the 21st century, we're going to try to do a kind of special celebration, exploration of what the role of poetry, what the role of the arts might be, should be in the 21st century. and hope to gather at the end of May and beginning of June a large group of wonderful and nurturing writers and thinkers to both celebrate poetry through readings and discussions and music and dance, and also to engage quite seriously in a series of dialogues about the role and purpose of poetry and the arts in the 21st century.
How many poets might we expect to have?
Well, we're aiming for somewhere around 40, I think. And then, of course, everybody who comes is a poet. So
the general public is included. That's what a point I'd like to make, that years ago, Southern Maryland was not the center of culture. I don't want to hurt your feelings, Michael, but it was not. And finally, it took a person. It always takes one person who wants to put their energy behind making something happen. And you opened up some conduits from Washington, from California, from Michigan. You started inviting national poets in. And this started, the mix and match of that created a tremendous vortex of energy. And over the years, for 2 weeks every spring, you've had the readings and the workshops and the wonderful things. But this year is going to be a grand celebration, right? 21 and still going strong.
That's what we're aiming for.
That's all right. Michael Glaser is his name, and we're aiming to keep writing as hard as it is. That's why I want you to read some more poetry, because the point is, Michael, that to be a poet and to present other poets takes a lot. It takes a lot, and that's why it heartens me to see a poet with a new manuscript, one who is providing for so many others in the world. You know, I get scared if I see blank pages because that means you're writing too many grants. So here he is, Michael Glaser, and this is not a grant we're going to hear.
This is a poem called Poetry, and perhaps expresses some of why I love it so much. Poetry. Wanting more than hope, I turn to poetry for revelation. Instruction for my spirit, courage for my reawakening soul. Call it what you will, truth or rapture or love's embrace. Call it what it is, the consistently unexpected surprise of beauty's human face.
Can anybody write poetry, Michael?
Sure. My friend Grace Cavalieri says, the difference between a poet and a non-poet is that the poet writes it down.
And I always think that's true.
I think it's true.
I sit in a room full of people, and I see, and I know everything I felt, they felt. I know that everything, as mean-spirited as could be, they have experienced. I know that everything generous in the world they have experienced, but they're just not telling it.
Poetry is about reporting out the meaningful experiences of your life. And anybody who has access to language can do that. I walk in, I do a lot of poet in the school stuff, you know, and I walk into classrooms and more I'm convinced. I go in and I say to the children, as I say to my students, I think there are three guidelines here. One rule, and that is that there are no rules. One permission, and that is that you have permission to make mistakes. And one truth, and that is that you're responsible for what you write. And then I can say to them, now, write a poem, and they will just get busy and write poems. I mean, that people have them in it. It's just kind of giving permission to do that. And there are lots of things you can teach about form and structure and how to use some of the tools of the trade. But poetry is a way of reporting out what matters, and anyone can do that.
Before I forget, I want to put out a phone number about your own work and the festival for people to respond to, and maybe that is the same phone number.
Well, we can do that.
Okay, let's do that now. And we can do it again later.
Area code 301-862-0239.
That will get you all kinds of things.
That's Poetry Central at St. Mary's College. And
get you information about the festival. It will get you Michael's books. It will get you maybe lift up your heart a little if you call that number. So we'll give it out again. Let's have, speaking of lifting the heart,
here's a poem called You Don't Want That. It takes place in a bed and breakfast with my wife. You don't want that. You don't want that. It's an expression I learned from my dad, a way of saying, let me help you. I know about these things. You don't want that. Usually it was set around food, though mother might have used it in the clothing store, or father about a book or magazine. You don't want that. I said it to my wife this morning about some canned grapefruit slices she was going to eat. She thought they were just fine, but for the life of me, I can't understand why. You don't want that, I said, trying to be helpful, feeling somehow important, a man of savoir-faire, worldly-wise, experienced, feeling in short like my father, and proud of it, of course, when my wife looked up at me with brows so tight the twinkle disappeared from her eyes as she said, "It's not possible for you to imagine someone liking something you don't like, is it?" I stared at her. I'm 54 years old. I'm tired of being wrong. I'm tired of having so much to learn about who I am, and I'm tired of discovering that having become like my father doesn't make me a man. I don't need that, is what I wanted to say. But the truth is, I do. And so I ate my bacon, becoming strangely silent, like my father after his third bout with cancer, when he'd look out at a world he increasingly did not understand, and with a gentleness we hardly recognized, would say, astonished, "Imagine that," over and over again. Imagine, imagine that.
Michael, how will it be for you to be remembered for canned grapefruit? Because that is your legacy. I can't look at a can of grapefruit without thinking of that poem. You have certainly immortalized it. But you know what that canned grapefruit is about? Self-knowledge. Guess what? You can take it in and learn self-knowledge. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Kathy did a good job on you.
She's doing pretty amazing work.
And we're at the Library of Congress doing our work. One more, and then I have some questions to shoot at you.
Here's a poem about my older daughter. My daughter turns 18. It begins with a quotation from her. "I'm going to sleep on Jonathan's boat tonight," she announces. "And what is my role now? What do I say? What silences are best observed? My mind reels. What if this and what if that? What if this guy ruins her life? Well, not ruins it, I think, but she has such potential. Possibilities stretch before her. I can't control the father in me, blurting out, blurting on and on. And this fellow, this Jonathan, a sweet boy, no doubt, but must he spend every moment of the day and night with my daughter? Must he love her so unconditionally she turns blind as stone? You're a flower, I want to say, a sprig just potted in rich soil. You're blind with infatuation. Get a grip, I want to yell. But I calm myself. Such words would hurt. Her eyes would well up, her untamed spirit flinching back. What do you know, she would snap. What do you know about love? Insistent, demanding, a question my age has begun to suggest I ask myself as daily I confront my failures, as here too with her, what do I know about love? I fall silent, dumb. I turn to prayer. It is my last best hope, perhaps my only hope. Dear Lord, I mumble to myself, dear Lord.
That's what you know about love. That poem is what you know about love.
Thank you.
Do people say that you've instructed them? Do people say, "Oh my God, I went through that with my daughter, and I can't believe you came out and said that"? Do people get more of what they need from poetry and from yours?
I think good poems do that for us. They help us feel less alone. I think we have a curiously human ability to think that we are the only people who've ever experienced or thought what we experience and think. And that it's not confessional poetry, but writing about our experiences enable us and the world around us to say, wow, we live in this community of sweet people trying to get by the best they can. And
that line, nice though, that what do you know about love, Daddy? What a line. Yeah. And that's what I think is awfully important for us to point out, just as far as technique goes. The dialogue in the poem brings such life. Your characters bring such vitality. Situations, things that are alive and breathing work in the poem very much, don't they?
They need to, I think. And I should speak to that line just a little bit because it's a made-up line. And my daughter, who I love dearly, says, Daddy, you know I would never ask you that question, God bless her. So that line gets created so that the character in the poem can confront the speaker in the poem with that moment of looking at himself about what are you projecting out onto the world, Father, and bring that back into what you do know.
Excellent, because that was in her heart, though. I mean, you drew that out of the air, out of the ambience. That's what she was really saying. Mm. And that's very, very important. And so when she hears that poem, she sort of defends herself?
No, she knows
she understands.
That I love her.
I'm hip. Right. Now, you go into the classrooms, and you have been doing this for, 13 or 14 years as a poet in the schools, in addition to, are you chair of the English department now?
Right.
Okay. And teaching 3 courses and trying to do your own work and being a father and writing grants for poetry festivals and running poetry series and all of those things. You go into the classrooms. You go into the third grade, the second grade, the first grade, all over the country, and you teach children that it's okay to be who they are and to say it out loud. Then you go and teach teachers how to do that. How do you teach a teacher to liberate those little souls that are in her classroom? What in the world do you say? How's your approach?
I'm the same way I teach students. I mean, I think it's all hands-on. You do it, you experience it, you know how wonderful and important it is, and then you can share that with others. I don't think there are no gimmicks to it, but it is a matter of doing it. So when I work with teachers, I take them through the same kind of workshop things that I would do with my students and that I do with the students in the schools and say, look, you can write poems, they can write poems, and it's this process of giving voice to our experiences that is what matters. And
not too long ago, you were in the Frostburg area, the mountains of Maryland, and you were working with teachers in a specific context of, it was to prove that children learn more when arts are in the classroom, or am I?
Well, there's much research that indicates that arts, people engaged in the arts are more effective learners in all areas than people who are not engaged in the arts. So it was a workshop trying to focus on how we can infuse more arts into the curriculum and make those connections for students.
And do you think you made some inroads?
There were wonderful teachers there, and
they all wanted to do good things.
Good people from the Maryland State Department of Education and the Maryland State Arts Council. Mm-hmm. So it was a great experience to be a part of helping these everyday classroom teachers who are in there working with kids to see how they can use, in my case, poetry as part of their daily teaching.
Do you realize we always think there were poets in the schools, but this is just a new thing since the 60s. And actually, it was started by Dr. Herman Ward in New Jersey. It's a very new phenomenon. And I say, thank God. Michael Glazier's here. I say, thank God for that. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We are at the Library of Congress.
This is a poem called Rehearsing the Past. Give it an idle moment. And my mind cannot resist its obsession with rehearsing the past. Eating or reading or just walking dully along, the past sneaks in for scrutiny, for remembering, for what-ifing. driving or going to sleep, the past is there, popping into the VCR of my brain, its brooding horde of instant replays, its insatiable questions, its insistent wonderings why, its constant urging that I relive again what I cannot change. "Did you turn the stove off?" it asks. "Were you not aware of this? Did you have to say that? Did you remember to raise the toilet seat? Did you lower it? What were you thinking? Are you really that ignorant? Were you thinking?" What is it in me? What drives this obsession so strong the present catches me unaware? What do I want? Absolution. Absolution. Just once to hear from the world what my daughter has programmed her computer to say, "That's okay, I love you anyway. Whenever there is an error, for each mistake, that's okay, I love you anyway."
We've talked about the creation of the poem and the teaching of the poem. The publishing business has to be mentioned because every time we see a new group come into the classroom, the first thing they want to know is, how do I get published? Which is sort of ludicrous. And you very quickly change all that energy. Someone I know just emailed me, Ken's old swimming coach actually, and said, "I need some money, so I've started writing poetry." Hmm. I mean, how naive and how sad. Where do we get published? How do we get published? And does it matter? I think you and I are proponents of the small press, very much so. Time-honored tradition in America, for which we would not have T.S. Eliot, William Carlos Williams, Ezra Pound, all the luminaries, were it not for that. Now, is it still the place that we have that we can hold on to? What do you think?
I think publishing is a way of feeling affirmed in what we do. I also don't think it's particularly what we do is about. Judith Hall talks about the po-biz, and I like that distinction a lot, that publishing is really about the business of poetry. But being a poet is not about publishing, it's about writing. And that's a distinction that I think is important to make, that whether or not you publish is not why one writes, and the desire to be published probably takes you away from finding your own voice and writing what you have to say and telling your story in the best way you can. So there's a lot of ambivalence I have about that. I would never deny the gratitude that I feel and the excitement when I get published. And I think we all like that recognition, but it's not what writing is for.
I like the places you publish, though. I like picking up the Christian Science Monitor and seeing a poem by you. It's very much that you are in the mass media, and you publish with most unexpected places like newspapers, as well as traditional literary journals. I like that ecumenical way of feeling that you're sort of the Mark Twain, and it doesn't have to come out of New York.
I like publishing in places that people read. And I find newspapers and magazines with mass circulation that may not be considered prestigious journals, people read, and I'm grateful to be read.
Now, we have to talk about things that are going wrong in the world, and that is that we don't know the outcome of the internet on the word. We can only fear for the content providers, who are not writers, that are providing grist for the mill. We know that massive bookstore chains are now in place, that advances are given to celebrities instead of writers. And so is there much to fear? Not that it changes our work every day at dawn, but is the book on a short tether.
Is the world on a short tether, did you ask?
Yeah, I think I did. Now that I think of it.
It's all interconnected, isn't it? I get kind of passionate about it, I guess, but we need to reclaim the sacred in our lives. This earth, this environment, this world, human relationships, poetry, bookstores, small presses and large, kindness and love. These things are getting buried somewhere with the stock market, and I don't claim to understand it, but I think that the arts are a part of affirming the sacredness of the human experience, and that's what matters. And anything that works and is about that is just fine with me.
Even radio. And so here he is on radio, Michael Glaser.
Let's go back a bit. Children of Eden. Sometimes I try to imagine what it was like for God as he watched over the garden and Eve, to whom he had given freedom and but one command. Is it wrong to assume that she was little different from my children or me? Or to think it was not defiance so much as simple curiosity she left as her legacy? And how could God, we might want to ask, leave that choice, that consequence, to such innocence? And dare we, cradling our own sweet children, acknowledge in them equal freedom, equal power? Can we, too, say, okay, well, here's the key, drive carefully, never knowing for sure if they will return or at what hour or what they might choose to do with such freedom, such illusions of power?
And another.
The Curator of Dreams. It is perhaps the noose I put my own neck in when I go to my children thinking I might save them from their nightmare dreams, and so speak their names gently again and again, saying, I love you, stroking their hair with such priestly care, I imagine old demon truth would not dare to fill their ears with my own nightmare fears, telling them what they have already begun to understand, that there is nothing I can do to relieve their pain, but whisper these words, my prayers, their names.
How have you been transformed by writing?
Well, writing is a place where I can be my best me. And so the more I write, the more I live out being the me I most wish to be, perhaps. I think in that way, writing does transform me. It helps me see the world and be in the world the way I most wish to be. How's that?
And it calls in everything, because there's rejection, there's acceptance. I mean, writing calls in everything that one could feel. There's being truthful, there's being false and knowing the difference. There is everything we can do in life we do on the page. And that is so interesting, because you're confronted with it, you take it in, and you try again. It is a very interesting way of being alive on many dimensions and levels.
Growing up, I used to, I think I had an imaginary trophy case in which all the reasons people would like me, you know, were there as trophies that I would like to show. So I say, come to my trophy case and let me show you why you should like me.
Oh, tell me some of the trophies.
Well, I don't.
Oh, come
don't
on.
Get too personal.
Just one trophy.
Oh,
I am handsome.
I'm not sure.
I'm entertaining.
It was funny, entertaining. Oh. Thoughtful, whatever, but that what was really important for me here is to understand that that people would like me for being me, in all my humanness, with my foibles and my failures. And it wasn't because I had all these things to show off about. It was because I was just me. And poetry is a way of affirming that just me-ness into the world also.
This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Michael Glaser is here telling us some of the thoughts that we don't always know about poets when we read their poems on the page. And on his page is some new work I've never heard before. Here's one in front of him.
It's a poem called Migration. Again, you have left your solitary sleep and journeyed on child's feet to the warmth your sleeping mother makes, this breathing space you've always called your own. Too tired to move you, I yank the blankets to claim back my share, to remind you that I too am here, grumbling to myself, this is not the way things are supposed to be. And you roll toward me. Your head migrates unerringly to that space beneath my chin where you snuggle in as if to remind me that whatever the day has been, the love that fills this bed is more than I might claim by right or dreams to know. And so I fall asleep, embraced by the breathing that fills this space with such delicate and, yes, such undeserved grace. Working on a series of poems called Blessings, and Marsha Lee Falk has written a book of blessings, translations of Hebrew blessings, which I'm in debt to for these poems. Here are some of them. Blessings. A blessing for this family. For my grandparents, of whom remembrance is a blessing. For my parents, for whom gratitude is endless. For my children, without whom I would have so much less to bless. For my wife, Kathleen, without whom not. A blessing for children. Blessed be our children who take us out of ourselves, who teach us, even as they grow from us, the glory of this love. A blessing for being awake. Blessed is every moment, the ones I notice, the ones I miss. A blessing for friends. Blessed is breakfast with friends, mornings that begin with honest chatter, eggs and coffee and talk that matters, as we affirm this space, these connections, the grace we make of this time, this place. A blessing for the woods. Before I leave, almost without noticing, before I cross the road and head toward what I have intentionally postponed, let me stop to say a blessing for these woods. For crows barking and squirrels scampering, for trees and fungus and multicolored leaves, for the way sunlight laces shadows through each branch and leaf of tree, for these paths that take me in, for these paths that lead me out.
Mm. Michael Glaser, are we going to have a book of blessings?
That would be fun to do, but I don't know. As I've been writing them, they start feeling repetitious to me. So maybe over a long period of time, as I keep growing and learn more and more how blessed this world is, it might happen, but not right now. Love poem for my wife, like God, perhaps. The face of my love is etched with images I am awed by again and again. She has measured the waters of my soul and surely has found me wanting. Yet look, she loves me. She loves me.
Great last lines. Three little words. They're powerful, aren't they?
They sure are.
In the right place.
Yeah.
Now, had they been in the beginning of the poem, it would not have made any sense whatsoever. Just three one-syllable words, rightly placed, can be as if never heard before. That always blows me away.
Love, as I get older and older, I find it's like that, though. You know, it just is always amazing, and it stays there, and I think what's hardest is accepting that, just accepting that, and receiving it.
We're going to have a final poem, I say, regretfully.
This is a poem called Vespers. It is no abstract hunger, this longing for voices that do not need to be heard, the wish to sleep at night close to the one you love, to wake refreshed, share coffee, address the day, and leave for work looking forward to evening, to the comfort and blessings of home.
Michael Glazier, you're going to give relationships a good name. This is not popular, you know.
Good. Good that I can give it a good name.
We are with Michael Glazier. We are at the Library of Congress. I am Grace Cavalieri, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We wish to thank the Motion Picture Broadcasting and Recorded Sound Division of the Library of Congress for support of this series. Our engineer is Larry Applebaum. Post-production is by MET Audio Works. The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress is made possible by the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry. I am Grace Cavalieri.